From Edge Radio 99.3 FM, this is an edit of The Dice Men Cometh, the podcast.
The Dice Men Cometh!
Hi-ho, and welcome to The Muppet Show, because it's the show run by Muppets.
Yes.
Of course, the question is, which Muppets are on the show this week to talk board games and card games? Kermit, Miss Piggy, and Gonzo.
Yes.
Shut up, Miss Piggy.
Shut up. Oh, shut up. A Zubat just appeared.
I forgot.
Anyway.
I'll leave you to figure out which one is which there. Anyway, my real name is Trent.
My real name is Leon.
And a Zubat really appeared, but my name is Garth. Now, we are talking this week about everything that is hot to print. We are talking about the hottest of the hotness. That would be Scythe, the biggest game that's come out at least in the last couple of weeks and possibly the year. We are talking about potentially the game of the year as well, with Karuba that's up for the Spielers Yaris. We are talking about the hottest and most exclusive gaming convention this side of any gaming conventions, with the Gathering of Friends. And you guys, especially you, Trent, may have heard of a little thing called Pokemon Go.
Heard about it. It's all... I had to put up with you playing it in the car on the way here. I'm amazed that...
Come on, don't you like the noise, the sound it makes?
I play it and I still think you're an ass.
That's because I caught more Zubats than you.
Okay, all that and more coming up on The Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. Garth.
Yes.
Put the phone down.
Oh, come on.
Put the phone down.
It was a Starmie.
The Pokemon can wait. Put it down.
Okay. That was the Deftones with Prayers forward slash triangles. You are with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3. I am not looking at Pokemon Go anymore. Now, before we talk about the hottest game that there is in the planet at the moment, just wanted to mention last week's episode may or may not have been eaten by internet demons.
We don't know
exactly where it is at the moment. We do apologise. Our technical boffins are boffining to try and find where it is.
In terms of putting out the podcast.
Correct.
Which might end up coming out in reverse order.
It very well may do. But this is episode 124. It is the 14th of July. And now, Trent, you can talk to us, with us, and for us about everything hot that is Scythe.
Because we're giving Mark the night off tonight, which means we might be able to get through a game description in less than 20 minutes.
Well, the clock is now ticking.
Okay, here we go. We're talking about Scythe. From Stonemaier Games, designed by Jamie Stegmaier of Euphoria, Tuscany, and Viticulture fame. Stonemaier Games do produce a nice-looking game, guys. Are you with me?
Very, very purdy.
Yeah. Look, it's a fast-playing area control resource management game of such lavishly over-the-top production that it just sets a new benchmark in dressing mutton up as lamb.
Oh! we should bring Mark back to do the buttons, because that is brutal.
And speaking of just good-looking games, I think all gamers were hooked from the moment we glimpsed the first bits of art for Scythe. Giant steampunk mechs stomping through cornfields, striding alongside megafauna, bison and direwolves in some kind of alternative World War I landscape. And, of course, the Kickstarter promised all sorts of goodies, and it's finally arrived.
Yeah, and oh boy, has it delivered. Oh my God.
So what is it? So Scythe, and this is your game, Leon. You back this.
I back this. Garth backed it as well, so two of us.
Oh my God.
Leon actually listened to me do a Kickstarter update and backed it. There you go.
That was back when I was a fan of the show. I'm not anymore.
It's a hex map, basically, of something vaguely European looking, with impassable rivers and lands that produce sort of bog standard resources, wood or sheep.
No, food.
Oil, food.
Oil.
Oil, food.
Food, wood, and iron.
Each player gets a couple of boards for themselves, one for their four mechs that are awaiting development. You've got to build up and deploy those. Each mech grants a special power, like Riverwalk, to get across those impassable rivers. Then there's the action board that each player gets, which is where really the game's guts take place, I think. There are four basic moves that each player can choose from each turn. Move, you're mixing your meeples around.
Yep.
Produce, resources from the hexes where you have meeples.
Yep.
Trade, which is kind of misnamed, yeah?
Yes, because it's basically produce, except you get to pick what you want.
Yeah, but it costs you a dollar. You are trading your money.
That is
are getting whatever it is you want.
Purchasing would be a better name.
Yeah, but this is 1920s alternate Eastern Europa. It's trade.
And so is your face.
And bolster is the final one, which is what? Just put more dudes out.
Yeah.
So these are at the top of the player board, and they allow you to secure enough resources to do the accompanying second action from that section of the board. Build, deploy, enlist, and upgrade. So you choose a basic action from one of the four sections, and if you can, you do the accompanying second action from that section.
Yeah, but this is where I immediately like these player boards, because you're right, you've got each got your faction board, which tells you whereabouts you're going to start on the board, what race or sort of clan you're starting from, therefore what mech abilities you're going to have. But then you get to the player board, which is where you've got those basic actions followed by the bottom actions as well. Now, very simply, but something that I think adds a lot of interest to this game is that everyone's player board has a different combination of the four basic moves paired with four of the different actions. So although every action themselves is the same, the combination of the two is different. So I might have a move up the top action and an upgrade down the bottom action, but Trent, your player board might have something completely different, which for me just keeps things a little bit more, I guess, unique as the player.
And also you get extra different resources from the bottom as well. So there could be something that you go, oh, with my character, I wouldn't really do this too much, but I get lots of money for it, so why not? But then the next game you play, you could have the same character, different board, and go, well, now it's even better or even worse.
So there's some slight variables in the player powers. Upgrade is a really important action because that lets you spend oil to improve the efficiency of all of your other actions, which basically involves moving wooden cubes around, little notches on your player board, which slot into little cut spaces in a very satisfying way.
Yes, the notches were good. I saw in the description that you could put cubes into notches, and I was like, all right. And then I saw it, and then I did it and went,
Not now, coming from a guy who played this game in his full Russian hat with his bear puppet thing.
Hey, don't believe us. The photos are on Facebook.
The photos are on Facebook. And, I am not.
And it was a tiger. Thank you very much.
Sorry, a tiger. To make that guy go, he knew it had to be special.
Yeah, because Russians never go,
No, they go, yeah.
And so you're moving your bits around the board. You're trying to gain territory and resources, and you're occasionally running into each other for a little bit of combat, which is about as easier a combat system as you could possibly ask for. But how do you win this beast? Well, it's not a war game, and it's not a victory point salad. Not quite, ish. Anyway. Yeah, it's based on popularity.
Yeah.
Of course. Because the more resources you spend on certain actions, the more popularity you'll get with the cute little farm folk, and this exponentially increases the value of some little wooden stars that you place on a space for achievements throughout the game. So that might be for your first two combats, deploying all of your meeples to mine resources. I think you get 8 in total, achieving some gold cards. What were some of the other achievements?
All your mechs out, yep. Getting to the top of the popularity chat,
or the power.
Getting to the top of the power and
upgrading all your upgrades, of your potential options. Right. So you've also got all your recruits that you could have enlisted.
And each one of those stars for those achievements are worth points. The more popularity you have, the more points they're worth.
So you could literally focus on any one thing out of all the stuff you could do in the game, and it is leading you to victory or to more money or more popularity.
Yeah, but the good thing is for me is that it is also the end of round trigger, because as soon as someone has placed their 6th star, immediate end of game. Now, this is quite good because it's a bit of a balancing act, because I might want to place my 6th star to be able to end the game, but I also can make a pretty quick assessment and go, I probably don't have enough of this and that to actually be competitive and therefore be the ultimate winner.
And by complete coincidence, Leon,
yes,
we played Euphoria from Stonemaier Games.
We did, the night before.
Employs exactly the same mechanic.
Except the game actually ends when that final star hit Where the next day when we played this, I thought, oh, it's the same thing. It's a race, which is pretty cool for a game this size. No. It's a race, but then you've got to get points and stuff at the end, and that's where I kind of lost focus for half the game.
You could finish the race but still lose.
Lose very badly, but finish the race very quickly.
We played this once with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It went fairly quickly. Mark won. We should just put that out there.
Yes. But Leon came a close second.
He did. He did very, very well, that young
which,
man.
Considering that Mark was, like, caning us halfway through the game.
It looked very pretty while we were playing. I think we all enjoyed it. And at the end, I just kind of went, meh.
Oh, dude.
And look, all the hype that's been around this game for over a year now, all the plastic, all the lavish art, it's just a lightweight mashup of a bunch of things that we've seen 100 times before, frankly.
What I said on the night, I said was, what was it? It was Euphoria, which we played the night before.
Yep.
Blood Rage and Tiny Epic Kingdoms, which I've played, but you lads haven't played yet. It is pretty much those three games mushed together with not a lot of originality other than the theme with the World War One-ish mix.
I think it's mushed together very well.
Oh, that's the thing. Those three games are three pretty good games. So it's not a bad thing in the slightest.
But do we really need another area control resource management game at this point in the hobby?
Yes, and I'll tell you why.
Why?
Because this board is double-sided, and the other side of the board is exactly the same as the normal side of the board, but it's all a lot bigger, so you have to have another attachment.
Right, right.
And it takes up the whole table, and it's
okay,
beautiful.
Okay, no, therein lies the appeal of this game. It's just that everything's bigger, shinier, chunkier. It's the components.
Yes, I agree. And it is amazing because that is what sucks you in. Now, this game has tiny little bits of role play element. And I guess the main thing for that would be the encounter cards.
Infinitesimally.
Yeah, no, not infinitesimally small, because you draw those encounter cards. It explicitly tells you in the rule book to show everyone so that everyone else gets sucked into the world that you are populating. You get to make the choice. Am I going to be a nice leader of a clan? Am I going to be a ruthless leader of a clan? Am I going to be a self-serving ingrate?
It makes no difference.
Yeah, it's a bit second prize in a beauty contest.
Oh, come on.
The cards
the
are the one,
$20 I ever won.
The cards are the one thing that I thought were a bit... but everything else I enjoyed. I liked the fact that there was a game this big, there's lots of different strategies you could do, lots of different replayability with the mixing of the boards and stuff. It is a game that I would like to play again, because now that like I said, when I first started playing it, I just did that race to the stars and then realised, oh, no, that's not what you should actually do. And yeah.
But I like the fact that there are 10 possible ways to get your 6 stars out there.
Yes.
And it allows everyone to run their own separate sort of method. Now, I like the fact that, for the most part, it sort of balances quite nicely with interactivity and solitaire play. You can really get your own little engine up and running.
It's true.
Because you can get your economy running so that you can produce mechs, or so that you can build your structures, or so that you can enlist recruits to get you ultimate bonuses and what have you. But, and this has been said a lot in the forums, it is not so much just the combat, it is also the threat of combat that makes your decision making a little bit more focused, I guess, because you'll go, well, I want to get this mech out because it allows me to do a river walk.
I don't know about this, because I went into combat, I think I had 3 combats through the whole game. And look, granted, I didn't win, okay, the game overall, but I knew the result of every combat that I was going into.
Yeah, well, look, combat for me is probably, I would say, the weakest or the lowest.
There's not much
complication.
There's not much in it.
You essentially...
It's not a combat area control game.
No, it's not. It is area control, because that's ultimately part of the final scoring. But the combat is something that the loser of that combat is going to suffer a pretty hefty penalty, which is whatever was involved in that combat is going to go all the way back to the home base, and you've got to reset your strategy and go from there.
But the one thing I will say about that was good is that at no point did I feel that anybody else's actions was completely destroying what I was doing. Some of these bigger games, you get halfway through, someone does just one thing that screws you over, and then you just sit there in a misery for the next hour and a half.
Leon, that's a really good point, because the thing that I came away from with this is that the whole thing was just really easy.
Yes, it's true.
Right? Now, that's either brilliant, okay, for somebody who's new to the hobby, seeing photos of this and picking it up, and this might be their first game or one of their first games in their collection, or it's really crushingly disappointing for us old farts.
Well, that's again the tricky thing, because this thing made over $1.8 million on Kickstarter. It was the top of the most anticipated games for 2016. So this had a hell of a lot of reputation to live up to. In the 1 week since I've started paying attention, and I only really started paying attention when I got this message on my phone saying, something's on its way to you. So I went, oh, it must be so. It has gone from 600 and somethingth in BGG to now already be number 96. So it has had a hell of a positive response, admittedly from the BGG users who have gone on there and voted. But to go from 600 and something to being the top 100 games of all time in the space of a week is a pretty incredible result.
Yeah, and the good thing about it is this game is heavy, but it's not complicated at all.
It's literally heavy.
It is literally the
box weighs a ton.
And those coins in there, yeah. But yeah, it's not hard. It's just there's a lot of different things to keep track of. I discovered at BorderCon something that I always kind of thought but wasn't 100% sure that I actively hate, and hate's a strong word, but I hate... I hate complicated
what
games.
What do you do? You hate them.
I hate them. Complicated games I find no enjoyment out of whatsoever. But bigger games, longer games, I'm fine with, but just the complexity is what kills me every time. Right. And this game, the fact that I watched a 20-minute video before coming around, and I knew every facet of this game. There was no questions in my head whatsoever. I knew every single thing of it. And I was actually right after watching one 20-minute video. And with us, anyone who's listened knows, between sometimes the three of us, we'll sit down with a game that says 60 minutes and will take us 3 hours. We played a 5-player game of this, and if you take the learning out of it, the box says, what, 5 minutes under 2 hours?
Yeah, 150
minutes. I think we actually did it in slightly less than that.
Agreed. And that's one of the really benefits I have, because the joy of these double movement where you're doing the top part of the player board, then the bottom part, it explicitly, again, says in the rules, as soon as the player to your right has done their top row action, just start doing your thing if you're the next player, because almost always it does not interfere with your go. The speed of turn for a game this size is excellent. It is certainly on the middle size of gaming weight. It is not a hard one, but geez, it is beautiful.
Is it getting a retail release?
Yes.
I imagine it must be.
Yeah, and there's an expansion that's already been announced, because it's just awesome.
So if you haven't got it, you can decide for yourself, is it the greatest game of all time or the game of the year, or does the Emperor have no clothes? Which is what I personally think. But hey, I'll play it again, just to be sure.
Damn right.
And just to play with those mechs. All right, what are we going to do next? Because Mark's not here this week, but he's given us an interview that he's recorded about the gathering of friends.
Yeah, with good friend of the show, Rachel. Well, so how about we play that next?
All right.
And learn what it's like to be all in the gathering of friends.
That was Miss Destiny with The One on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh. We're now going to play for you a little interview with absentee Dice Man Mark and a friend of ours, Rachel, who attended a special exclusive little event in our little board gaming world.
So imagine you're invited to a getaway where the world's most influential and famous game designers want you to check out their latest games before they go to press. Sound like your dream come true? My friend Rachel from Melbourne got to live this dream. Rachel, how did you get to be part of this amazing event called the Gathering of Friends?
By invite only from Alan Moon. So every year or every couple of years, he opens it up so people that have been going there for, you know, a number of years can nominate and then second someone that they want to come and, you know, become his friend. And then after that initial vetting process where they have to give lots of information about that potential person, they have to get another couple of people who will second that nomination. It's a rigorous process. It's been going for 27 years now, so it's quite a close-knit group of, you know, a lot of people.
And this is Alan Moon, creator of Ticket to Ride, and it's basically like his private convention, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I think when it started, it was, 20 or 30 guys who went and stayed in a cabin somewhere. And then they met more people, invited more people. And yeah, it grew to the 350, 450 size event that it is now.
Tell us about some of the people that we might know that you played games with this time. And perhaps even you can tease us, if you can, about some of the games or just some of the themes that you might have played this time around?
Okay, so the highlights have been, obviously meeting the gods who write the amazing games, and being able to engage with them as people who do these fabulous things, but essentially people. So, you know, one of the really fun things when I was playtesting 504 with Friedman, you know, a couple of years ago, so I just dropped that in, was him saying, "That's a terrible move. Why would you do that move?" You know, and getting a lot of that from him. And being able to just, you know, so getting to know people like William Attia, the guy who did Spirit Room, who is, you know, an amazing brain, great designer, and just a really, you know, lovely conversationalist, you know, a really lovely guy. So for me, the highlight has been being able to try out new things while they're still in cardboard or on bits of paper, and then seeing their development over the last few years until they come out in their glossy forms.
So, Rachel, one of the things that I'm curious about, and I'm sure our listeners are as well, what sort of stages are these games in?
Yeah, so there's a huge range. Some of them are in that really kind of basic prototype state. So, you know, pieces of card with things drawn on them. Through to, so that's in the really kind of early prototype testing phases. And it ranges through to far more developed playtesting, where the components are more polished. You know, there may be printed cardboard, but the mechanics are pretty much solid. So the objective for the designer is to kind of put the game, the narrative, and the mechanics through its paces with a set of people that they may not have been able to play with. So people that are going to be able to break the game a bit. Through to games that are pretty much finished and then are being kind of spruced for to be picked up and developed. So, for example, one of my friends, Brett Myers, who did Rome, a couple of years ago, he had brought Rome there. It was in its final stage. It was picked up by R&R Games in the first 3 days, and so he couldn't play it with anyone anymore because they were picking it up for development. Yeah, it's really, you know, it's really exciting. So actually seeing these things happen, you know, guys bringing their games out, playing, and then it being snapped up by any of the developers or distributors there, and then it coming off the table because it's now owned, you know, by those guys.
So I wasn't sure if there was going to be sort of distributors and game companies, do they have much of a presence?
The group has enthusiastic players. You know, there are well-known game designers. So Vlada Cetil, for example, Alan Moon, you know, the big names. And then there are the smaller kind of boutique or lesser-known game designers who, you know, who are kind of working on their stuff. Then there are the distributors, so the guys from R&R, Z-Man, Space Cowboys, that kind of. I don't think there's anyone from Rio Grande. I keep gazing, hopefully, you know, longingly to see Rana Knizia. I haven't seen him yet. Then there are people who own game shops, Summer Game Games, you know, things like that. Then there are people who are the bloggers, writers, do the kind of stuff that you guys do.
I did hear a rumor that you were locked away in a room with Matt Leacock, and clearly, you know, Matt Leacock, Pandemic, and of course, the game of the moment or the game of the year, Pandemic Legacy. Obviously, down the track sometime, he's going to have Pandemic Legacy Season 2. What were you and he and that small group of people you were locked away with, what were you up to? How much can you tell us?
I can't tell you squat. We signed non-disclosure waivers because, you know, which was a first for me. There tended to be a range of looseness around disclosure. So my experience over the last few years has been mostly that people, when they're in development with playtesting, they're mostly quite happy to have photographs on social media for people to be talking about and creating a bit of a buzz and engagement. And I found that as things get closer to that development or, you know, pick up by a distributor phase, that people put the, you know, they become more mindful of their intellectual property, I guess. And this was one example where, you know, so we couldn't take photos and we can't talk about the game itself, even in really broad terms. What I can say is that it was a really good experience. And Matt and Rob were really happy with the, you know, the outcome of the really rigorous kind of putting it through its paces.
You said Matt and Rob. This is Rob Davyow, isn't it?
Yeah.
You were totally playing Pandemic Legacy Season 2, weren't you? No, don't answer that. I don't want to get you in trouble. Oh, my God. I can't believe it.
So these guys collaborate quite a lot. They have a few things going on in the pipeline.
I'm sure they do.
I felt this funny kind of tension between, you know, as I got to know these people as people, kind of reconciling, enjoying just getting to know them with the kind of hero worship, oh my God, can I take a photo with you kind of thing. But there were many, many instances. So the first year that I went, you know, like I took, you know, I toted over this really heavy tome. I don't know if you've seen Rules of Play. It's this big text, you know, all about game design and stuff like that. So I toted that with me across to the States, intending to get people to sign it, you know, get autographs in this textbook about game design. I didn't get a single one, because when it came down to it, I didn't actually want to do that sort of distancing thing of, oh my God, you know, you're a game designer, will you please sign my book? I really just wanted to hang out with them, have a cup of tea and play with them, you know? One of the things that's big there are all these kind of social events, dinners, a werewolf until 4 o'clock in the morning that's run every night by Ted Allstack.
Is there someone that when you met them, you were really surprised, like they were really different from what you thought they would be?
Yes. I met Yaron, one half of Splotter. And based on what I knew of Splotter games, you know, they're heavy, they're pretty dry. So I was expecting someone who was very serious or, you know, kind of not someone that would gleefully, you know, photo bomb at the slightest opportunity and really, really playful and, you know, very gleeful. So that was kind of a surprise.
What about the opposite? Who's the most serious person there?
Look, William Attia. I mean, he's not the most serious, but I was really, I don't know, I was expecting someone a little more flamboyant. What I was surprised about was how lovely and how friendly Alan and his wife Janet are. So after the first year, I made friends with one of Alan's friends, and I stayed with him for a few days after. His friend Bruce had a dog, and I was really missing my dog, so he said, hey, come and stay at my house, and you can pat my dog, you know, as you do. And Alan discovered that I was staying at Bruce's, and so he invited me and Bruce to his and Janet's house for a games day. After, you know, being at my first gathering of friends, I then got invited to a private games day at Alan Moon's house.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And, you know, got to spend more time with a bunch of other people that I'd met at the gathering. But that just blew my mind. And they are just such lovely people. You know, that was one of the things I was really surprised about, the genuine warmth and interest that they held. They've sent me holiday cards for the last 2 years, you know, based on having met me a couple of years ago. You know, that's really special. You know, it's really unexpected.
Now that you're on the in crowd, does that mean, like, you're in forever? You can go whenever you like?
Yeah, he has some rules about continuity. So if you haven't gone for, I think, 2 or 3 years or so, you have to renegotiate going back with him. And some people, because not everyone that comes works out. So I think, you know, he uses that as a way of kind of closing the door if people didn't kind of get on with, you know, play nicely with the other people. Yeah, once you're invited, you can just keep going back. Unless you royally mess up, you know. There have been situations in the past year where people haven't honoured the, you know, that kind of mutual respect, which I think is always a risk in this sort of quite unique mix of hunters, designers, distributors. But, you know, over the years, there's potential for people to take advantage of this privileged sort of experience. But they don't last long.
Any last stories you want to tell us just to make us even more jealous?
The prize table. So when you confirm that you're going, you confirm whether you're going to be contributing to the prize table or not. Always contribute to the prize table because, oh my God, it takes up about a quarter of the ballroom. This is a really, really big room. And these tables are piled high. So people bring stuff. So normal punters like me will bring a game. It gets vetted to see whether it's of sufficient quality to go onto the games table. Distributors and designers, they'll come. So Friedman brought in like a million copies of Power Grid or, you know, Fearsome Floors or whatever, you know. So people will bring buttloads of stuff and put it on the table. And then on the last Saturday, Alan hosts a prize table ceremony, and he pulls out our name badges from a bucket. So the red badges, which is the people in their first year, they go through first, and then women go through first, and then he calls up the names, you know, randomly. He'll get up and they choose something from the prize table, And then once everyone's been called, it's basically a free-for-all. You know, you can go in and often he'll call women up again to go and have another pick. So you can come away from, you know, this evening with, you know, like two suitcases full of games.
So, Rachel, thank you so much. If everyone who has heard this is not super, super jealous, then they've got far greater willpower than I. It sounds like so much fun. And such an amazing time. Thank you so much for your time. And maybe you'll agree to come back and talk to us about this next year.
I'd love to.
That was our Dice Man colleague, Mark Rickards, talking to Rachel Gay inside what sounded like a radioactive S-bend about the Gathering of Friends, the world's most exclusive game convention.
Mm-hmm.
The other benefit about not having Mark here is that we don't have to play Billy Bragg,
Missy Higgins,
Kate Miller-Heidke.
Yep.
And pretty much whatever the hell we want, including one of the greatest bits of cock rock ever recorded from David Lee Roth. Yes, I'm going there. Wow. And his album, Eat 'em and Smile. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for the Shy Boy.
That was David Lee Roth with Shy Boy on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Man coming. Now, God. Karuba.
Karuba indeed. Oh, dear God, that song was...
Hey, that song featured more notes than Elton John played in his entire career.
Yes.
That's got to be worth something.
That's true, but I've been so used to the slow, melodic, quiet music of Mark that instruments were just... Anyway.
You'll be back in next year.
We are going to talk about potentially one of the games of the year. It's already in the top three in terms of Spiel des Jahres nominations.
We are talking. Yeah. We don't mean just like Scythe hype game of
the year. No, we're talking actual bona fide game of the year potential material. We're talking Karuba, which is up there with Imhotep, which you talked about last week, which unfortunately probably no one's heard yet because the episode has disappeared, and also Codename. So I think we'll have to maybe just sort of touch on them quickly again before they announce the winner next week. So this game, designed by Rüdiger Dorn, who designed Istanbul, which is the 2014 Kennerspiel winner, and also Goa, which is basically top 50 games of BGG of all time. So he knows how to publish designer games.
That's been out there a while.
It has been. Yeah, it's been out maybe 10 years or so. Okay. So, you know, he's been around for a long time. This was published by Harper. Now, what is Karuba? Where is Karuba? Well, I can tell you that Wikipedia is absolutely no help when it comes to this. Because according to Wikipedia, Karuba is a village in Nord Kivu, the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the only thing that you'll find out about it is that there was a massive fight there.
Is that what this is based on?
No, it's not. Karuba is an island that you will travel to because each player is about to control a team of intrepid adventurers attempting to navigate through a whole bunch of dense forest in search for riches, like crystals and gold, or to find those elusive hidden temples.
Well, the box cover looks like a cartoony Indiana Jones kind of thing, doesn't
it? That's exactly what it is. So every player is playing a team of adventurers. Now, the great thing is this is a super quick 10 to 30 minute game, depending on the number of players. So immediately you can start to see why this kind of game is spiel worthy, because it's all about just accruing the most amount of treasure by the end of the game. Now, you're going to get treasure by obviously successfully getting the gold and the crystals, and also by getting your adventurer to this temple. And the way it's going to work is kind of like a Carcassonne mechanic in that there's going to be a whole bunch of tile laying. However, each player is going to have their each individual board. Now, this is a 5x6 square board where you're going to be placing tiles as they go. You get four adventurers. Each adventurer is of a different color. They each have a respective temple that you will be trying to get your adventurer to as quickly as possible. And the last thing you're going to get is your own personalized set of 36 tiles. So this game plays up to four, but the good thing is you are basically having this little solo puzzle that you're going to be trying to solve as quickly as you can, because this is a race game to get your adventurers to the temples. Now, the way this game starts, and this is something that I really, really like, is each of the players collectively and cooperatively are going to decide where to put all their adventurers on the board. And the adventurers have to start on one of the beach squares. And then they all have to agree where you're going to put the temples, basically the targets for each of your adventurers. So that ultimately, before the game's even started, every player board looks identical.
Yeah.
So you're starting with that. Then
and
one
the player boards are just blank.
They're just blank
and you're
boards.
Just you're drawing tiles and putting them...
Well, you will be, because the next part of it is one player who's the mission leader or the expedition leader is going to shuffle all their tiles and place them face down. Everyone else is then going to face their tiles face up, because they're all numbered, and put them in some order so you can easily see which numbered tile is which, because they go from 1 through to 36.
So numerical order, perhaps.
Numerical order. You could do it by numerous other orders.
Or alphabetical, so in which case, what number would be first in 1 to 36?
Doesn't matter. So,
oh, anyway, we're all stupid, don't worry. Sorry.
So then, what you're going to do is very, very simply, the player who is the expedition leader with the face-down tile is going to choose the first one, read aloud the number of the tile, and every other player is going to grab the same tile from their little player board, and they are then going to choose where they put it on their board.
So what you're saying
it's
is...
Eight is the first one.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm actually glad we resolved that.
Not
make,
a trouble.
It does make me feel better. What you're saying,
yes,
is that this is bingo.
No.
Oh, it sounds like bingo.
No, it
every player's
not.
Got a board.
They have got a board.
The leader's calling out numbers.
Yes.
This is freaking bingo, man.
No, it's not.
Five
because
is next.
The way it's going to work, what about 18? Is that...
Are you...
thank you. Is that each player will decide whereabouts they get to place their tile. Now...
Leon's sitting here thinking really hard.
Of the alphabet.
Yes.
That's because I've played this game. I know what he's talking about. So
well,
yes.
Contribute then. So, once you have decided where you are going to place your tile, that's basically how the game's going to work. The mission leader is going to choose the top of their stack, read the number, each player gets to choose whereabouts their tile laid. Or...
if they have that number.
No, because everyone has the same number tiles, 1 through to 36.
Well, that's pretty shit bingo then.
Well, exactly, because everyone's a winner in board gaming. But the decision-making happens where you can choose not to play your tile, but instead throw it away and move one of your adventurers the number of spaces equal to the number of path entrances on the tile. So if there are three path entrances, Trent, you can move that one adventurer three spaces. That's right. So you've got
decisions.
A little bit of a decision-making process, otherwise known as a choice in this game.
Good choices make for good games.
Correct.
I think four is fourth.
Exactly. So you've got a very simple game that plays
actually,
in...
Actually, 14 would be fourth. No.
No, it would be
no.
After.
4, 14.
14 would be
fourth.
Fifth.
Fourth is not a number, is it?
All right, I miss Mark now. So anyway, you've got this little decision to make, which is, am I going to place this tile because it fits perfectly, or am I going to throw it away because it has four path entrances and it means I can move my adventurer four spaces? Now, where this differs from a lot of other tile placement games, like Carcassonne or Isle of Skye...
And Bingo,
is that you cannot rotate these tiles at all. They always have to stay in the same orientation every single time.
Well, as you first put them in, or...?
Yes, because they will never rotate. They will always be...
But I can choose which orientation I put them into my player board. No.
No, oh. They always have to stay the same orientation with the number of the tile, in alphabetical order, numerical, however you want to, in the top left corner. So you cannot rotate those tiles. Now, the good thing is, it makes this game easy to teach. Had you been listening, you would now be able to know how to play this game. So that is good.
Sorry, which game is that?
What I like about it is that I could quite easily teach it to my kids, and we could be playing this game in the space of 5 minutes.
You'd probably rather be doing that right
now. I think so. What I also like about this game is that it fits in a really nice amount of game in a very short amount of time. You can play this game two-player in about 10 minutes. It is great for starting a game night, finishing a game night, in between heavier games. And it's just good, clean, harmless fun, because once you get your adventurer to the temple, and the aim is to get all four of your adventurers to the temples as quickly as possible, you've got that well-worn mechanic where the first player to get there is going to get the most points and the second player will get the second most and so on for each of the respective tiles. But along the path, you've also got little tiles that'll have the crystals or the gold on them. And again, this is where the choice comes into it, because the only way you are going to ever earn those bonuses is if you decide to stop your adventurer on that tile and collect the gold. So you might ultimately have a movement of three. You might decide, I just want to stop here, get the one gold and forfeit the rest of my movement because you can do that. So I really like this game, Leon. What did you think of it when we played it at BorderCon?
I enjoyed it quite immensely. I looked at it and just went, no, this doesn't look like much. And then we played it and went, no, you could literally play this like 100 times and it'd be different.
Yeah.
And the fact that, yeah, you could teach it to somebody really young and you could slip in nicely, as you said, anywhere in a game night. That's, yeah, I was quite impressed considering I looked at it and just kind of went, eh. And then I played it and went,
Yeah, I agree. And,
as is
and
my want.
That's good. So you've got very Russian there with your sayings again. So look, I just find this game to sort of fit a really nice sweet spot. The fact that it is absolutely suitable for all ages, the fact that it is quick and easy to teach, the fact that it comes in a relatively compact box, which is excellent for carrying it around. I really like the fact that you can easily see how, although everyone starts in exactly the same position, everyone has a different strategy. They have different paths. I like the fact that you are essentially doing your own individual puzzle solving, but you've also got to keep involved in everyone else's move because ultimately it is a race. You need to be able to compete with every other player. And if I see Leon is moving his brown adventurer towards the brown temple, I want to get there before him. And Trent, if you're trying to, you know, make lots of money by getting crystals or gold, then I need to keep an eye on that strategy. So it keeps you involved. You're not just working on your own thing.
And this is actually a German game, isn't it? Yeah. So, yeah. I don't know. This sounds... I'm interested in this now that I've half listened to what you've said. And I would have to say that this might be in with a good chance over Codenames.
Well, it sort of is a bit more... gamey, I guess. It's got a lot more strategy potentially involved in it, but it also has something that the Spiel judges look for, which is a huge amount of replayability because, you know, that random bingo draw, as you say, allows the game to have massive amounts of replayability where no games will be the same.
Well, we will learn the game of the year next week.
Yeah, it's all happening, I think, on the 18th of July, which is only 4 nights away.
And we'll be back to talk about that next week on the Dice Man Cometh. It's Edge Radio, 99.3 FM. I came here to change my mind. Edge Radio, 99.3 FM. Trent, Leon and Garth on the Dice Man Cometh and Esther Holt with a song about barley. Gentlemen, I'm really pleased that you managed to stop playing Pokemon Go long enough to do the show tonight. Thank you. Really, very, very much.
You're welcome. Guess what? Now we're going to talk about it for a minute. Because we have to. Because it's just a cultural phenomenon, so we've got to get it out of the way.
Because Nintendo is changing the way society actually functions.
Yeah.
All of a sudden.
Well done, Garth. So, the game, as everyone knows, I'm not going to explain too much about it, because you know what it is. If you've got on Facebook or Twitter, you've seen it all. It's at 15 million downloads in a week alone, and it's not even launched in a lot of places except for Australia, the US, and I think a few other select places.
It got to the point where the Tasmanian police put out a press release warning Tasmanians not to play the game while they were driving.
Yeah, within 3 days, it has become more active on people's phones than Twitter or Tinder. So there you go. And they've been around for a while, and apparently things that people like.
And it hasn't been released in Japan yet.
No, which is, I mean, God, that's going to be mayhem.
And look, because Australia's got such crappy Wi-Fi and internet coverage, as soon as people get the data bills on for the next phone bill, this is going to stop.
Well, you'd think so, but you never know. As long as people keep finding, you know, dead bodies and all that kind of stuff, which did happen, by the way.
Yeah, and look, far from being some kind of youth apocalypse, the way, you know, many oldies think... And frankly, I would have thought the Gen X knew better than to label this game as some kind of scourge. I think this is potentially really exciting technology. I mean, I'm not interested in the Pokemon property at all, but what an exciting idea that could be applied to just gaming in general.
Yeah, because the main thing that Pokemon does is that it uses the idea of augmented reality, which we kind of seen in board games in... The only game I can think of is the world of
Yo-Ho.
Yeah, where you've got the big board, and it's the pirate game where you've got the big board of all the oceans and islands and stuff, and you actually put your smartphone on it, and your smartphone becomes the ship that you use in the game.
Wow.
But the thing is, though, that game came out last year, and I've not really seen anybody talk about it too much or buy it, which says to me that maybe the game's not too great, but the idea of it is brilliant. And since Pokemon Go has now become this cultural phenomenon so quickly, a lot of game developers will probably quickly go, well, we could have an iOS version of a component of our game, which has been a thing with like XCOM and other things. But if we could get this augmented reality thing in there, you know, that's just a whole nother ballgame. There's so many, you know, limitless possibilities.
Yes. And I've got one for you guys. Here's my elevator pitch. Flashpoint.
What? Right. Yep.
Augmented reality flashpoint, where you were running around your own house, putting out augmented fires, saving augmented dogs and kittens before your augmented house falls down and burns you to augmented death.
That could be a thing. I had another one, a thought on the way here. For something like, say, Descent, which people get together, say, once a month, play through a campaign with their friends. You have the character on your phone, and you'll get this little vibrate message once every now and then when you're out and about that says, like, there's a monster nearby. And just like the Pokemon game, your little guy will come up on the screen, you fight the monster somehow, and then when you come back to your campaign with your friends at the end of the month, hey, guys, I just earned an extra 20 gold.
I can do even better than this.
Sure.
Imagine Pokemon Go with a Warcraft skin.
Whoa.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
Right? License to print money.
Definitely.
Okay? But I was thinking, look, you could... This would transform LARPing.
Oh, for sure.
Okay? Yep. I mean, because that's essentially what people are doing, live action role playing. Mm-hmm. You could play D&D in the streets.
Yeah, all right? Agreed.
You could rock up to your friend's house at 4 a.m, jump into their backyard and declare war from outside their bedroom window. That's not creepy at all. That's gaming.
Well, that's also what's happening right now anyway, with people trying to take Magikarps out of people's backyards or whatever. Yeah. What about a real life-size version of Five Tribes? Look at that. Wouldn't that be amazing with everyone having their own phone, being a meeple, moving around the squares like that? I think it'd be phenomenal.
Yeah, or real-life Monopoly.
Yeah.
Just to take it down to a really prosaic gaming level.
I did think...
Playing in real locations.
That's why I thought Chinatown would be a perfect opportunity. You've got to meet up in a real-life corner, in a real-life establishment, exchanging the value of it as a game.
Or just brilliant. You could just play like cash and guns and just shoot people. No, that doesn't work.
With your phone.
Hang on, that's
with
just,
your phone.
That's just violence, isn't it?
Just take a photo of them instead.
Yeah,
hey?
Right.
I'm sure you could get Arnold Schwarzenegger to advertise it.
Yeah, why not?
He's hard up for a buck these days since the divorce.
Yes.
All right, so we've agreed that Nintendo has changed the entire world with Pokemon Go. As sad as that might be, we live in strange, strange times. So strange that we'll be back next week to talk about it some more. The Dice Man cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. Until then, I don't know, enjoy.
Bye. Yes, and goodbye.
See you. Okay, we're going.
Yeah. Same.
What comes after 14?
15. I don't know.
This has been an edit of the Dice Men Cometh from Edge Radio 99.3 FM, Hobart's independent youth station. Find us on Facebook and edgeradio.org.au.